This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.
Are you there, Sam?
Yep, hang on, I'm just turning that on.
Is our guest ready?
Yep, I've got the music ready.
Can you hear me okay?
Yep, sounds great.
Cool. Otago Access Radio, in partnership with Otago Polytechnic, brings you Blowing Bubbles.
Blowing Bubbles brings you positive conversations with people in their bubbles around the world.
We're curious about how people are finding new ways of life, being and problem solving. Every Wednesday, the Sustainable Lens team of Samuel Mann and Mawira Karatai reach out from our bubbles to chat with interesting and positive people around the world.
Broadcast on Otago Access Radio, 105.4 FM in Dunedin, and streamed and podcast on oar.org.nz.
Bringing joy, connection, kindness and peace in all the days ahead.
Welcome to Blowing Bubbles, positive conversations with people in their bubbles, their safe spaces around the world. I'm Samuel Mann, and today I am joined by Tim Lynch. Welcome, Tim.
Thank you, Sam. Glad to be here.
Tim, last year we did a series which we call Devonshire Tea with a Slice of Anger. And you're back for more. Just one more in this part of the series.
Just one more to round it up. As you know, my doctorate is split into three sections. First one being anger, the next one being hope, and the final one being action. And as a template, it's used by various organisations around the world. So we're going to revisit this idea of anger, because what I realised in those conversations I was having is it was only coming from one side, from this one side, and that point of view was that climate change is in fact happening. And what I realised is I was creating my own echo chamber by only speaking to those people that agreed with my worldview. So I had to push myself out a little bit and actually go talk to someone who their source of anger is coming from the fact that they don't believe that climate change is occurring, or they believe that climate change is a naturally occurring thing, and that they're angry at how it is being used to manipulate and change things such as legislation. So in that case, I actually rang around a few people, and I managed to get hold of many various groups that I never thought I'd speak to. Eventually, I had one person who came back and said, yes, I'm happy to have a conversation with you about that. So I had a conversation with a councillor called Lee Vandevis from the DCC. And his point of view on climate change, climate denial, is radically different to mine.
I'm Lee Vandevis. I'm a city councillor, first elected 2004, and currently under Jules Raddick, got my first ever chairmanship because I've never been popular with previous mayors. I'm now, for my sins, the chair of finance and council-controlled organisations at the DCC. Come from a long line of builders on my father's side. My mother was a botanical analyst. After the Second World War, she was one of the first people to come out of Utrecht University with a degree in as a botanical analyst. And my father had been in Indonesia, which was like, you know, Holland's Vietnam, and didn't get on too well with his father, wanted to get away and be independent. Talked my mother into marrying him and coming over here for the honeymoon. And the idea was that if they liked it here, they would stay, and if not, they would just head back. And they liked it here, and they set up a building business. My father did all the Dewey tool stuff, and my mother did the quotations and quite often the painting and stuff as well. And they had three boys, and I was child number two, so I've got middle child syndrome. My father getting me to do all the shit jobs on the building site, cleaning out the trenches and things, and me being resentful, and him saying, Lee, it's all useful work. And he used to repeat this to me, and it took me a long time to actually get my head around the fact that not everybody has useful work to do. And if you're in a position where there's something useful you can do, well, you should go for it. I think, who's the guy with all the podcasts? Jordan Peterson said you should always take the path of maximum responsibility, because that's where you'll get maximum growth personally and also where you'll be most effective. I've always found that there's something useful I can do, I'm not a Christian as such, although I like Christian values, but it's my understanding of God will provide. There's always something useful you can do, and the trick is just to find what that useful thing is and go for it. And keep going, because if you ever stop, you've got to start again, and it's so hard. So, yeah, whenever I get up in the morning, I've already kind of decided the night before what I'm doing first thing, and the wheels are still spinning, and away I go. And if it's not a council meeting, then it tends to be head out to the farm and got all sorts of projects.
I've had some people on this show. No, we're going to leave it at that. Okay, let's start with useful work, finding out what the useful is and getting on with it. That sounds like a good place to start.
Let's do that. Let's start there. So the first thing that struck me about this, Sam, and it became quite difficult to find someone who wanted to talk to me about their opinions on climate denial. So that was the first thing I had to ask Lee is, you know, why do you think no one wanted to talk to me about other theories surrounding climate change?
In a word, fear. I was lucky enough to be a young man in the 60s and 70s and lived in what I consider to be the most free part of all of history, and probably in the freest part of the world where you could be free then. You could say anything you liked in the 60s and 70s, and if you made a prat of yourself and said something completely erroneous, well, you just showed yourself to be the prat that you were. These days, things have become much, much more constrained for reasons which I'm still grappling with. We are no longer the free society that we used to have, you know, 40, 50 years ago. There is so much now that is expected and demanded of people in terms of compliance. One of the drivers that I've identified in terms of this compliance, and it's across the Western world and most of it's imported from the United States, is corporate. If you look at the big corporations, they have no interest in people's individual freedom. They have no interest in people looking after and maintaining themselves. They want everybody hooked into the grid. They want everybody on some lines of medication. And they have managed through a lot of international organisations, United Nations, the World Health Organization, the WEF, to essentially impose on all Western nations levels of compliance, and a lot of those are justified in terms of we're doing it for your health and safety. Health and safety being the two most dangerous words of the English language now. Your health and safety are the reason where, you know, you basically have to comply. So you've got this bunch of industrialists who set themselves up as the World Health Organization. They are basically pill pushers, and they've been pretty clever about it. It's been going on for at least 50 years, where they've got themselves in a position now where they do some good for the world in terms of, you know, producing sort of levels that are acceptable of different toxins, for instance, and things that you should do in the event of an outbreak of whatever disease. But essentially, they are pushing compliance and health and safety regulations on everybody that culminated in the appalling COVID vaccination response, which would be a whole other can of worms which we could talk about sometime. Are we a sovereign nation? Are we sovereign people? Are we able to be sovereign individuals ourselves? And I think it was a lot easier 40 or 50 years ago than it is now. I have to work really hard at having my voice heard. I have been absolutely panned through the local monopoly media. If it wasn't for social media, they would have destroyed me in terms of being an elected representative here. Luckily, social media have been able to present a slightly different view. I have challenged the old boys and they're running their various gravy trains in this town. One of the main reasons Dunedin lags behind every other city in New Zealand in terms of disposable income, in terms of house value. A lot of people don't realise that in New Zealand your average house value is $933,000 and here it's $657,000. It's a third less. So we have less disposable income and we're living in poorer housing than any other city in the country, by a country mile. All of these things are a result, as I said, in my view, of a lot of corporate welfare going on here. And the fact that we've always voted Labor hasn't helped. There's no central government interest in Dunedin. Why would they, when they're never going to get a seat here anyway, unless they've already got them? So, yeah, the reasons why everybody is essentially buying the climate change narrative, even though Al Gore, since 1987, has been saying the poles will be melted within 10 years, well, 20 years, 30 years, 40 years have gone by, and they still haven't melted. People are still buying the narrative because they get hit with it constantly in all the mainstream media.
There's a whole narrative here of buying climate change because you're hit with it constantly, but we're hit with buy more stuff, way more. And I can't quite get my head around.
There's complexity in it, there is. I guess at this stage I had to ask, you know, the blaring thing, which is, you know, Lee, you know, why do you not think humans are contributing to climate change?
Because I look at data. If you look at all the opinion that you get and these constant things, like there's been, I think, five of them this year in the ADT saying, oh, you know, warmest month since records began, you know, warmest year since records began, biggest wildfires since records began, worst flood since records began. You've got to ask yourself what records they're talking about. We have records going back 1,000 million years, and these records are available from the Antarctic ice cores. They're available from various other quite reputable scientific places, and you'll find a lot of this data on my blog, leevandevis.com. I keep putting up the data that shows 1,000 million years of climate world temperature versus CO2. And there are quite reputable scientific papers showing what the world temperature used to be in ages gone by and what the CO2 levels were. There is no causal connection between them. Sometimes world temperature has been high and CO2 low and vice versa. Why should CO2 suddenly now be the cause of the world getting warmer? Certainly the world has been getting a little bit warmer lately. But it's only 13,000 years ago we had the major ice age. We had a few mini ice ages in between, and we're due another one. We're due another major ice age. Again, if you go to my blog, you have to go through hundreds of pages of other stuff because there's a lot of politics there, but you'll find independent graphs, and they're all properly sourced, which show that our climate has been cyclic forever, that there is no causal connection between CO2 and world temperature, and that we are currently in a slight warming phase, but that it's highly unlikely for it to make any real difference to sea level rise. And if you want to check the data on sea level rise, you go to, if you want to check locally, you go to the Port Chalmers tidal gauge. Google that and you'll see that the Port Chalmers tidal gauge hasn't even shown a match head thickness in sea level rise since records began 100 years ago.
Okay, so Lee is not here to actually have a debate with us.
No.
We're trying to understand what drives him and what makes him angry. But let it be said that I could argue with every point that he's made.
But I guess in a lot of ways that's the point, isn't it? That everyone can argue this from each way. And that's why I had to talk. And what is it, the epistemic standpoint? I know what I like because I know what I don't like. So I guess for me it was as important to have a conversation with someone I didn't agree with as much as it was to have a conversation with someone that I do agree with.
How do we get to this point? Did you talk to him about why this thing, which seems so obviously science-based, has become so polarised?
Yep, absolutely. And I think it's the polarising of the argument which is preventing any, what I would consider, reasonable conversation or debate around the subject. And it is polarising. And one of the things that I find is that the more that you try and shut down one particular argument, the more you start to push the narrative of the conspiratorial narrative that it's been concealed, that it shouldn't be let out.
Because both sides aren't providing evidence. One side is providing a whole lot of opinion with very short-term and not logically structured supposed evidence. And there isn't really another side. It's all the corporates have all the money, they have all the media, they have all their agendas to make us fearful. And people these days are incredibly fearful. And when people are fearful, they're very easily controlled. And that's what it's all about.
I think it's a whole different mindset. This idea that people are trying to make us fearful.
I would agree with that. And if you think about this narrative of fear or this narrative of control or mistrust, particularly the narrative of mistrust, pretty much every second program that you watch on Netflix, particularly if it comes out of the United States, in some way or form has that narrative woven through it in some way. So I think it's all around. It's where and how we choose to look or see it. And I think for some people that notion of mistrust is much stronger, I think.
The people that we had on before were trying to disrupt systems, but Lee operates in systems, in the council.
Yeah, I suppose, and it's interesting when you think about that, because if you think of like Rosemary and Jen, who I spoke to, you know, they're very much about the collective. They're about being part of a community. Whereas often the flip side of that coin is more about the individual. The individual's right. And a lot of these kind of climate conversations that you have, they view a lot of the mechanisms surrounding climate as ways to control individuals. And it's eroding their individual right. So it's interesting that Lee works within this established system, which he inherently disagrees with, working from the inside out, I suppose. As a councillor, have you seen this polarisation affecting the decision-making process at a council level? And did you think it's limiting constructive conversation? Because it is politically charged, irrespective of how we choose to look at it. There's a political narrative in there as well.
Absolutely. I mean, especially since Mayor Cull got turned by Green activist councillor Jinty McTavish, the council has been very focused on climate policies, and it reached its complete level of madness under Mayor Hawkins, who claimed that climate is the only paramount thing that we need to be concerned about. Everything else is secondary to climate. We've got to get people out of their cars, otherwise the planet will burn. And up until recently, the head of transportation at Dunedin City Council was a guy by the name of Sargent. And he'd said to all councillors, when I questioned them on these bizarre getting rid of traffic flow through George Street, getting rid of car parks, putting speed bumps everywhere, he said, "We've got to get people out of their cars, otherwise the planet will burn," end quote. This is who we've had running the council. This is why we've been spending literally hundreds of millions on cycleways. The only one that gets used is the one going around the peninsula. It's the only one I've ever voted for. And the only reason I voted for that was it's going to improve the road as well. All those cycleways, that massive cycleway up and down the one-way street system, you hardly ever see a cyclist on it. We lose $500,000 a year just in parking revenue because of the parks we lost to that cycleway. And the loss of revenue isn't the main issue. The main issue is the loss of parking and the strangulation of the CBD and the fact that everything is just so much more expensive here because people can't access the businesses they want to. A lot of stuff is moving out to South Dunedin now. There's extraordinary social costs involved in all of that. And if you look at the taxes and the rates that we pay and what we get for them, it's the value has just continued to decrease because, amongst other things, we spend $1 million a year at the DCC counting people's carbon footprint. Every department in the DCC, and I think there's 40-odd of them, has to do an annual carbon, where they monitor everyone's carbon for that year and see if it's gone up or down. The Dunedin City Treasury is one of the smallest departments that we have. There's only three people in it. They still have to get a consultant in to do their carbon footprint analysis for the year. You know, did they walk to work or did they take a dreadful car that was going to burn up the planet? How much did they fart at lunchtime? What goes in? It was 6 pages of consultant report just to monitor our carbon levels. And we're now demanding that our contractors that work for the DCC, which is where most of the money goes, they've all got to do that as well. Talk about adding cost and why. My suggestion has been, let's get rid of the group that we have, the well-funded group that we have doing all the carbon counting here, and just simply copy Tauranga's carbon counting, because they do it as well, or Hamilton's, because they do it as well. Just copy theirs and say, well, you know, we're a similar-sized city. It'll be about this. What difference does it make anyway? You want to save the planet, and yet you're paying all these people to do all this stuff, which apparently has to be done in order for us to know how much we're able to reduce our carbon impact. Well, the only way you can do it is to stop people travelling and shut down industry. Oh, and now they want to shut down farming as well because it turns out the cows are farting methane. It's absurd beyond belief. Everyone's bought into it because they're afraid to say anything else. I'm in the lucky position where I've been in council long enough, I've built a really strong voter base. I'm going to get re-elected anyway. There are a number of other councillors that agree with me, but they won't vote with me because they're afraid, A, of getting pilloried by their fellow councillors, the greenies on council, and there's too many of them, and they're also afraid of losing the next election. They're only a couple of hundred votes away from not being re-elected. I'm over 1,000 votes away from not being re-elected, so I can afford to put what I consider to be an alternative view. We've got all these councillors who claim to be, very keen on diversity. I'm about the only diversity there, and they give me hell for it.
Phil, well, I think we're okay for libel.
Just.
Well, he's allowed his opinion.
Yeah, it is, and it is that. It's opinion. It is opinion.
It's also his opinion, which he said absurd beyond belief, is that he's claiming that he's the only diversity in the room.
Where are you going with this one, Sam?
Privileged white man. claiming victimhood.
Okay. I see what you're saying. Lives in a leafy suburb in Maori Hill in a very nice house. Yeah, I suppose that you could say that. But in some ways, I don't think he's claiming victimhood for himself. I think he's claiming victimhood for others who think in the same way he does. I'm playing devil's advocate on this one. You know, like because that's the feeling that I got from that, was that he is not the victim per se, but you know, he views his role, savior is the wrong word, but as someone that is trying to right what he sees as the wrong.
There is worldwide, for the moment anyway, a political shift from the left to the right. Is he feeling vindicated?
I don't think you could not be. I mean, I'm just putting that out there. I mean, we look at a New Zealand level, international level, there is undoubtedly a shift that's gone from the left to the right. We think, you know, it wasn't that long ago we had, you know, Jacinda Ardern, who was very much about well-being, the well-being budget and things like that, you know, to where we are now with the likes of, you know, with Donald Trump. And so, I mean, I did ask him, you know, do you think this political shift from the left to the right is going to have an influence on local politics?
Yes, it'll take a long time to trickle down. I've resisted, and to some degree I've been effective in stopping some of the most ridiculous amounts of money that they wanted to spend. I mean, Councillor O'Malley wanted to build light rail out to the airport in order to save the planet, you know, because we'd burn less CO2. Well, never mind the cost of, you know, millions of dollars per kilometre to put it out there, and the carbon footprint that you'd get doing all that infrastructure, and the fact that we've got not many people going out to the airport anyway. I've been able to stop ridiculous stuff like that, or at least limit ridiculous stuff like that. If I wasn't on the council, I think it would be even worse than it is now.
I think it's time for some music.
Yeah, go on. It's funny, it'll be easy to go, you know, because this is about anger, and it'll be easy to go for the Bobby McFerrin and the, you know, Don't Worry, Be Happy song, but I think that'll be a little bit cliched. I think we can go for something different. Last year was one of the great years for music. 2024 will go down as having some just absolutely fantastic albums released. So we're going to listen to a song called Mutations, and it's by an artist called Milfa Yanya.
Just want your arms to bring me close.
You're listening to Blowing Bubbles. I'm talking with our roving reporter, Tim Lynch, who is bringing us his conversation with Lee Vandevis. There is a purpose for this. We're trying to understand anger, and I think we're getting it.
I think we're starting to get the idea. We're getting anger from a different point of view, rather than anger at the climate is changing, anger about people thinking that the climate is changing, if that makes sense. And one of the reasons that was good to talk to Lee is because he's a councillor, is the conversation around carbon affecting the democratic process.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, you try and get people to vote in a rational way when they've got this essentially massive greeny lefty clobbering machine waiting there to pillory anyone that speaks up. I mean, you might have seen what they've called me in the media over the years. Climate change denier. You know, it's only second to sort of Holocaust denier, really. It's like you're one of those. And what a terrible person you must be. How dare you have an alternative point of view? The science is proven. You know, there is no scientific question for these people.
So for yourself, Do you think that the climate is changing? Do you think the climate is changing was always going to, or do you think that we as humans are having no part of it?
Mainly the second one. Climate's always changed. I call it weather. You know, for the corporates to have made climate change into the one of the biggest international industries, for them to have done that with weather is pretty amazing. I'm old enough to remember that, you know, my wife saying that she didn't really want me to upset anybody, you know, and talk about the Maoris or talk about anything really contentious. And, you know, and my reply was, oh, okay, so I just talk about the weather, right? Well, now I can't even talk about the weather because, you know, that's going to upset people. People's sensitivities have become so great because they're so fearful and they've been made fearful when we have far less to be fearful of. If you look at a graph of climate caused death over the last 100 years, you'd expect with the massive climate changes we've supposedly had that death rates would have gone up. They have plummeted by 1,000%. And, you know, you can check the source of the graph. This is not just anybody just drawing a line on paper. This is proper research. Climate-related deaths have plummeted in 100 years. You would not believe it if you just read the newspapers. You know, CO2 levels have certainly gone up, and they've certainly gone up as a result of industry and as a result of us burning fossil fuels. They've gone up tremendously. Brilliant.
So are there any positives to increases in CO2 in the atmosphere?
My heritage was Dutch, even though I was born in Balclutha. And I've been to Holland a few times, and I've seen how the Dutch managed to be the second largest exporter of food in the world after the United States. And they do it with glass houses that are automated. They use drones, and they use CO2 units that manufacture CO2, and they pump CO2 into these glass houses to get this amazing production out of them. If you go down to Veggie Boys here, sometimes you'll see on special, you'll see these beautiful big red green peppers. And a lot of them are grown in Holland because they could grow them in Holland cheaper and send them over here than we can grow them here in New Zealand. And it's because they elevate the levels of CO2 in the glasshouses. Elevated CO2 levels are the best thing to happen to the planet in terms of food production. And if you go to my blog again, you'll see a graph, if you have to go down quite a way, a graph from NASA, and it's all satellite data showing that leaf growth has increased in most parts of the world between 25 and 50% as a result of the higher levels of CO2. And they say so as such. This is one of the enormous positives that you just do not see in the mainstream media. And it makes perfect sense. We live on oxygen, plants live on CO2.
Okay, so Lee's mother might be a botanist, but so am I.
Sam, you've done very well. You've done very well.
CO2 is not limiting in natural conditions. You have to work really hard for CO2 to be the limiting factor. Those glass houses where they're pumping it full of fertilizer, there's constant temperature, it's warm, massive sunlight, all those sorts of things, heat lamps and things, all that sort of stuff. Yes, in that situation, CO2 might be limited. It's not generally. It's not looking at things in terms of systems. It's looking things in terms of a single, perhaps easily understood, overly simplistic part of the system.
Well, it is. I mean, it is easy to look at these things in isolation, and you can pull these things out. You can pull anything out in isolation and try and prove it as being fact. I mean, a lot of the evidence that was, you know, he presented were around graphs, you know, showing a decrease in CO2 levels from pre-Columbian, you know, all the way through the epoch where we are at the moment, and also, you know, deaths related to climate catastrophes and how they are in fact decreasing, and the climate, the world, the globe is actually increasing in its greenery rather than decreasing, as he believes we've been led to know. My concern, I suppose, would be is that when you look at those things in isolation, you say, yes, they are happening, rather than, as you say, looking at them as part of a wider system, which is interconnected. And I believe we are starting to discover a relatively delicate set of interrelated systems.
And again, it's an overly simplistic way of looking at it. It's not about whether or not it's warming. It's not about whether or not the levels have been this at that level before. It's the speed at which those changes. It's the fact that there's more energy in the system. So,
for people who are listening to this, you can't see Sam's facial expressions at the moment. I know it is. And the other thing is, it's a bit like saying, you know, the great hope for Dunedin is as global warming because we're going to be 1.5 degrees warmer in summer, and it'll be fabulous. But it's all the stuff that comes with it, the increase of energy levels, which is in the atmosphere, and how that is related to the other wider systems, tides, wind, everything else. Yeah, so with this increase, and for me, and I'll be honest here, particularly with the way sort of council governments are looking at climate change, is the shift to adaption. And I mean, for myself, I find that a little bit concerning because it's almost a little bit defeatist. However, you know, I ask Lee, because he is a councillor, you know, how is the shift to climate adaption, how is that playing out in the council?
Particularly in South Dunedin, what I've been pushing for a long time is to spend money on bigger pipes and get some pumps in. I mean, the Dutch have proved that to be pretty successful. 60% of your Dutch population live below sea level, and we're worried here that we're only a metre and a half above. The Dutch would kill for South Dunedin. It'd be a great area for them. Do you see the Dutch putting an extra metre or two on their 3,500 kilometres of dikes? They've got the best hydrological engineers in the world, and they're making a fortune off everybody's fear of global warming and sea level rise currently. They're not worried about it. You know, there are some there, obviously, that do, but if you look at what they actually do as opposed to what they say, what we should be doing is getting the infrastructure running properly. Cleaning the mud tanks is something I pushed very hard for prior to the 2015 flood.
There's been talk recently about changing the parliamentary term to 4 years, and one would think that that will probably trickle down to local regional government as well. Did he have any ideas on how we actually make decisions over the long term when in this polarised view, polarised environment we're in, nothing ever changes?
Oh, it's not preventing anything happening. It's what it's doing is it's costing us an extraordinary amount of money to pay all these consultants to come in and tell us about how much it's going to cost to evacuate South Dunedin. There's been this recent attempt to try and get government to give us a whole lot of money to buy the properties off people so that they can then afford to move out. This idea that you're going to abandon South Dunedin is one of the most appalling devaluings of Dunedin ever to come along, and it's all utterly misguided in my view. Dunedin's probably a bigger case because we just have so much of South Dunedin, so many people living there and so many businesses there. We have so much built infrastructure there that South Dunedin is probably one of the bigger areas. There's certainly areas up north as well where, you know, if the sea level was to rise a metre, it would be a problem. But we all know that it's not going to happen overnight. And if it does happen, we've got plenty of time to actually do something about it. And the something that makes perfect sense to do is to put some bigger pumps in.
Status quo. I'm not sure. My feeling on it, to be honest, was that I think Lee was relatively happy with the status quo. That was my feeling on it. And I don't want to sort of put words in his mouth or anything like that. But it's that whole, the extending of the parliamentary term. I suppose it's great if you're happy with the government that's in place. So it's a similar thing with the council. So, you know, this kind of, this notion of things becoming stagnant or polarised because it's all just becomes too hard or too difficult to navigate. It's a bit like the adaption thing. It's a little bit defeatist, in my opinion, if I was to be honest, you know. But you could possibly say that what's happening in South Dunedin is an example of that. Because it's so polarised, you just get nothing happening because it's too difficult, it's too complicated, there's too many differing views that are coming across from it. So literally nothing happens. We have some people that are saying that we need to actually get out of there. We've got other people saying it should be left to revert back to what it is naturally, a wetland. You've got Lee saying we could put some big pumps in there to get rid of the water. Yeah, possibly. I'm not sure, Sam.
Worry is something we shouldn't be doing. There's far too much worry and fear about everything currently. People are afraid of the loss of the bees, they're afraid of the loss of the trees, they're afraid of, you know, acid rain. Acid rain was going to wipe out all the forests. That was around the turn of the century or even earlier. If you look at the latest data again, you'll find that the trees are doing better than ever. If you look at, the reef off Australia, that was supposed to be bleached and dying. Well, that's come and gone, and it's coming again now. What we should be doing as a local council is we should be putting infrastructure in to make us resilient in case of major weather events, mainly in our case flooding, period. We should not be spending $1 million a year calculating our carbon footprint, because our carbon footprint's no different to any other carbon footprints around the place, fundamentally. I mean, there might be slight variations. There's no real justification for it. The justification that I keep hearing is, how do we know we're improving our contribution to global CO2 levels if we don't, you know, spend all the money to do the counting? Well, there's a whole lot of assumptions in there which, quite frankly, just don't make sense to me.
It's interesting when people bring up acid rain or the ozone hole or Y2K and say that we're just, these things are being beaten up. And things like acid rain, it's not a problem. What did he say? The trees are doing better than ever.
Yeah.
Which is, again, massively oversimplifying a complex issue. Conflating recovery with a lack of past damage. It shows success at policy change. Forest health is complex. The system is real subtle. It's not just a matter of saying, well, we were worried about acid rain and now it's gone away.
Yeah.
I'm struggling with how you can be angry about something when the evidence that you've got for it not being a problem, you can poke so many holes in.
I think the anger comes from something more basic. I mean, the thing about all this kind of climate change discussions, all of this stuff, is that you're dealing with some pretty basic primal emotions. You know, fear of change, that's like one of the great fears, you know, particularly for climate deniers. I think there's this element of control that comes from it, manipulation. And that's where the anger stems from. I don't think, you know, hope, which we'll get into later, you know, hope is an emotion, you know, it's subtle, it's delicate. You know, it's about dopamine, whereas anger is direct and it's about adrenaline. So it's an immediate response. It's an immediate sort of physically visceral sensation that you have with it. And when you're dealing with a subject which is looking at things at a very personal level and surrounding things such as your beliefs, like earlier in the conversation, you know, Lee said, I'm not a Christian, but I believe in those Christian views. There is a lot of belief systems that say there is an overarching deity which is here to provide everything that we need going into the future. And if that's what you believe, then any manipulation surrounding that, you're going to object to immediately. I'm not saying that there's anything wrong with religion. I'm not saying that people shouldn't believe this. Everyone is entitled to their own spirituality and things like that. I need to be careful how I'm treating with this one. But that's just one of the things that you're having to deal with, you know. That's some of the stuff. So, you know, for someone like Lee, he doesn't need to worry about climate change. So is the conversation about the climate being muddied at a national level?
There's a couple of things here. There's the real big issue is the golden rule in politics. I don't know if you've heard of the golden rule. Golden rule in politics is them that has the gold makes the rules. Our government, like most government, are run by corporate interests. Their elections are funded by them. Their lobbyists basically push policy that would never pass any kind of rational investigation. And the golden rule is you've got corporate interests at a national level, and those interests are not our interests by and large. So that's one thing. You've then got a government who get elected and realise that everything is broken. All the institutions are not doing the jobs the way they should, and they're really keen for anything that they can divert people's attention to and say, look, this is the reason, you know. The number of cock-ups in government that they blamed on COVID, when COVID was the government cock-up. The number of cock-ups that they blame on, you know, the big flood that they had and all that timber that went down the rivers and blew out a few bridges. Well, you go back again and this they blame the weather for that, you know, acts of God and all the rest of it. A lot of it was actually poor planning. A lot of it was misinformation that came from NIWA and from the government's own weather people who had long been saying that these bridges are too low, they haven't got capacity for a 100-year flood, all of that kind of information they've had, and they push it to one side because they look a lot better if they can just blame it on the weather. It's just about as simple as that. Divert people from what the real truth is, spin a narrative which suits the global corporates, and keep a whole lot of consultants happy in the process.
Lee, if you could say something to the climate activists, what would it be?
Activists used to be, I think, marvellous people, but more recently they're not. Activism, to me, has just become kind of like a sort of a job, and people are expecting to be paid for being activists, and we've got a number of ex-activists that are now counting carbon at the DCC and getting paid very well for it. I've got a phrase that I've written a wee while ago here about activists. If I would just read it out, activists and policymakers should look independently at long-term data and facts rather than opinions before accepting a climate change narrative that is simply imported from the United States, much like the Indigenous rights narrative that it's also imported. Activism and its associated public funding drivers has become a politicised blight on New Zealand as activists indulge social divisions, imported ready-made, requiring no local thinking, research or context. If you look at the data, CO2 is a benign, tiny fraction of our atmosphere that has had very positive effects on plant growth and hence food supply since CO2 levels have increased due to modern industrialisation. Climate-related deaths have reduced dramatically, as I've already said, and in the last 100 years, when you look at the data, it's a complete contrast to the constant climate alarmism that you see in mainstream media. So my message to activists is just look at the data and focus on the many serious pollutants that big corporates are diverting attention away from. They claim diversity, but when confronted with it, they're utter hypocrites. They have a narrative. They cling to this narrative. It's not their own narrative. It's been imported. They don't want to have to think about anything. They just want to believe. It's like climate change has become religion now. And if you say anything against the climate change religion, you're a heretic, and they will burn you for it any way they can.
I mean, interestingly, I think that the response was exactly the same as if you were to talk to a climate activist. It's just the flip side of the same coin. Well, that's my take on it.
I think that we should give Lee some credit for coming on a show, talking to you, coming on to a show where the premise of the show has got opposing views to his.
100%. And look, these conversations aren't comfortable, you know, and I found it difficult. I found it difficult listening to someone who I disagree with. But that's maybe, isn't it supposed to be uncomfortable? Isn't that the purpose of these conversations, that they're meant to be uncomfortable? Like, I'm allowed to disagree with Lee. I'm allowed to. And he's allowed to disagree with me. And that's fine. But it doesn't mean that we shouldn't be able to have a conversation about something just because it's uncomfortable. It's that notion of those sort of, you know, outlaw emotions. We run away from anything that makes us feel uncomfortable. So yeah, this was challenging for me. It was a tricky one. I know it was certainly challenging for you, judging by your notes there, Sam. It's been a challenging one for you as well. But look, I believe it's important.
So Tim, we've had 4 people talking about anger.
Yes, we have.
What's the takeaway?
Right. Well, primarily, anger serves a pretty important function for us. It allows us to know what is important to us. If something makes us angry, it's because it is important. It's because we're responding to something. Also, that like anger as an emotion also falls into other emotions that we have. So the next one we'll be talking about hope. But there's a relationship between hope and anger. They're not binary separate things, that they actually intertwine with each other. I think the other thing about anger is that it's a difficult, uncomfortable emotion because it's hard to control. Anyone who's had young boys knows this, you know. Anger is something that is provocative and difficult. It's not passive. It's an outward emotion. It's not an inward emotion. It's something which is expressed outwardly. And so often it's displayed in different ways, all the way from people being willing to superglue themselves to a road, to being able to pour concrete on their hand on a road so they can't be moved, all the way to somebody feeling that they, in the halls of the council, that they feel obliged to stand up and confront people that they work with to the nth degree where they actually get removed. So my takeout from anger is that it's a distinctly human emotion. It's something that we're all stuck with. It's something that we all have to learn to deal with. But in some ways, it's something that we need to learn to move from, over or forward from, in order to have a dialogue, to have a conversation about something which is significantly important and arguably, you know, the greatest challenge of our lifetime.
Tim, thank you very much for that. I didn't think I'd enjoy that, but I did.
I'm pleased.
And where are we going next week?
Next week we're going to go to Japan.
Let's do that. Who are we going out to?
So we're going to go back to last year, 2024. Another example of a superb album that came out. This band in particular, the first album I loved, and then I kind of fell out of love with them and I came back. So this is Fontaines DC, and this is a song called Bugs, which is off the album they released last year.
Change my name to promise you, yeah. Dying inside, cause I want you, yeah. Didn't I say I wanted to, yeah. Honey, I changed before you, yeah. 28 years I come into end. The rain chased me down the gully again. Now I'm higher than anyone here, and there ain't nothing on me, yeah.
On the quadrilateral.
Conversations with people in their bubbles, their safe spaces around the world, brought to you by the Sustainable Lens team, which is brought to you by Otago Polytechnic. We're broadcast on Otago Access Radio every Wednesday afternoon at 3 and streamed in podcast on oar.org.nz. I've been talking with Tim Lynch, who brought us his conversation with Lee Vandevis. Moving on from anger, next week we have hope. That was Blowing Bubbles. I'm Samuel Mann. We hope you enjoyed the show.
This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On Air.